This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. More than once in this program, we've heard references to governments running short of bullets to deal with a weak economy. Jim Tankersley of the National Journal has been asking, though, what Congress could pass to fight unemployment and economic weakness in the months ahead. He's in our studios. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Your starting argument, I should point out, though, is that Congress keeps talking about jobs, but that they actually blew their chance to do something over the summer.
Right. Yeah, they just spent the last 3.5 months basically focusing on a problem that they created themselves, which was whether or not to raise the debt ceiling. And in that time, things got very bad in the economy. A bunch of data went south. They didn't deal with it. And now it's time for the president, for Harry Reid, Nancy Pelosi, and the Republican leaders, John Boehner and Mitch McConnell, to sit down and devote the exact same sort of attention to the jobs problem that they devoted to the debt problem.
Although we should point out, as you do, that there doesn't seem to be widespread political support for massive spending at this moment, as there was in 2009.
Absolutely not. No, I think that big spending initiatives are basically off the table.
So what is on the table?
Well, what should be on the table are a variety of things. I'm not sure anything's on the table right now. This is part of the problem. They're just not talking about it. But you could do some very creative things that could get some bipartisan support.
Such as?
Such as a free trade grand bargain, as I put it.
Mm-hmm.
You could pass the outstanding free trade agreements with Colombia, South Korea, and Panama, mm-hmm. and you could couple that with a serious crackdown on China's currency manipulation, which is something liberals want.
Because Republicans want the free trade agreements, and you say liberals want the crackdown on China. Didn't the Senate leaders, Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell, actually this week agree on some framework to consider these free trade agreements?
Right. They'll start moving those. And the important thing is, if you move those quickly and actually start opening up those markets, but you also do something about currency, then you could really start creating a lot of jobs fairly soon.
Fairly soon. This is something that could actually make a big difference in this economic cycle that we're in right now.
I mean, I think within the next year, particularly if you could really do something about, you know, China buying more of our exports would be one of the best things you could do. Exports have been a strength of this recovery. And if you could make that stronger by really upping how much China buys from us by getting their currency more fairly valued, you could have a chance.
What is one other thing that might be done that could boost the jobs picture in the United States and the economic picture in the United States?
Well, the big thing you have to deal with is the housing market. And this is, again, if there's something that Washington has paid less attention to than jobs, it's housing. But it is the big restraint in our economy. So you could, again, grand bargain time here. You could give Republicans what they want, which is to move people as quickly as possible through the foreclosure process if they really can't afford the house they're in.
Mm-hmm.
But then you could give Democrats what they want, which is some bridge loan type of abilities, some money for people who maybe lost a job and can't make their mortgage payments. You give them a loan from the government, like a student loan. Let them keep those payments up until they find a job, and that would stabilize the foreclosure rate and stabilize the housing market, which would lead to a lot of job creation.
Wait a minute. With the deal you're talking about here, you're getting people out of their houses they can't afford while also helping people to stay in the houses they can't afford.
Here's the trick. You have to figure out who can really afford their house and who can't. People who bought a house they just couldn't afford from the beginning, the people who with a subprime loan maybe or just bought way too big of a house, you got to get them out because they're clogging up the system right now with slow foreclosures. But the people who can afford their house, if they're working but just lost their jobs because of the recession, those are the folks you want to help stay in for now.
Well, Jim Tankersley of the National Journal, I want to ask one other thing. A couple of polls, CBS and the New York Times this week, as well as CNN. The CBS New York Times poll and a CNN poll show Congress with an approval rating of 14%. Lawmakers have got to know by now they seriously damaged their brand over the summer, more than usual. Are they actually going to feel pressure to accomplish anything this fall?
I mean, I sure hope they do. And I sure hope that they would actually come back and feel pressure not just to dance around and make big rhetorical statements, but to get down, again, lock themselves in a room, literally, until they can come out with some real agreement on jobs.
Jim, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Jim Tankersley is economics correspondent for National Journal. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montagne. The plunge in the stock market yesterday meant that this morning people were watching especially closely one key economic report. Jobless numbers. It's now out, and the Labor Department is reporting that unemployment actually fell last month, down slightly to 9.1%. And there were more jobs created than most economists were expecting. That's welcome news after markets took a dive, not just in the U.S., but around the world. NPR's business correspondent Yuki Noguchi joins us live now. And Yuki, put these numbers in perspective.
Well, so, as you say, the number of jobs added was 117, largely because of unexpected, sort of business job growth, which was 154,000, and that was better than expected. But, you know, at first glance, that sounds really good. But the concerning thing is that the labor force participation fell. So more people gave up looking for work, and that helped the unemployment rate. So, you know, this none of this is actually anything
helps that's gonna, it because they disappear basically. From,
right. There's fewer people in the labor force. So it's, you know, easier. The 154,000 number has a bigger effect on the rate. And that's why you saw the rate decrease. But, you know, none of this is really going to change the macroeconomic picture, really.
Well, let's talk about the markets then. Markets in Asia were down quite a bit this morning following those big drops in the U.S. Markets yesterday. Now, in New York, markets have just opened. What's the latest?
Well, it's really mixed. I mean, overnight and early this morning, you saw a lot of pessimism in the futures. And then they opened fairly big, but now they're basically about unchanged. So if you look at the market performance overall in the last 2 weeks or so, I mean, the Dow is down basically about 10%. And what they're responding to primarily isn't jobs so much, but Europe. The Eurozone is struggling with debt problems that are threatening to sort of burn the house down. And you got to remember that U.S. banks have a lot of holdings in Europe, so that's a vulnerability.
Well, can we talk about other economic indicators? They've not, of course, been encouraging of late. Does this report indicate anything has changed?
No. I mean, no. The news today is at best tepid. So not just for jobs and hiring. You know, what you've seen and what you just alluded to was manufacturing that's, you know, flatlined. Consumer spending is sort of not happening. And of course, economic growth during the first half of this year proved to be much slower than we thought. And so you hear now more talk of sort of going back into recession, the possibility of a double dip. And that's considered a possibility because basically we're just barely in recovery and we're just not on solid ground. So, you know, it could go negative at any point is the idea.
Yuki, earlier this week, there was another report saying mass layoffs seem to be making a comeback. HSBC, the bank, laid off 30,000 people like in one stroke. Borders Books liquidated and announced big layoffs. Is that particular strain contributing to the problem?
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting about that is you also saw, you know, mass layoff announcements from Cisco and Merck. And, you know, these are companies that are across different industries. And some of them are not necessarily responding to specific economic problems, but it's just not a good sign. I mean, some of them are, of course, related to the economy. Goldman Sachs announced some layoffs. And, you know, regardless, having, you know, that kind of, you know, addition to the unemployment rolls is not very helpful.
Well, one last thing about jobs generally in the U.S. Last month, we talked about government losing jobs, and that was a big factor in this report, which also showed very weak job growth.
Yeah. I mean, Minnesota, it shut down. That was a big deal, and that accounted for the bulk of the 37,000 government cuts you saw. And, you know, in general, government sector not looking good.
Yuki, thanks very much.
Thank you.
NPR business correspondent Yuki Noguchi. Many years ago, the movie Planet of the Apes told the story of a spaceship crew led by Charlton Heston that crash lands on a mysterious planet, a planet that turns out to be their own, Earth, in the future, where humans are slaves of apes. That cautionary tale led to more movies and now to a prequel. Here's Kenneth Turan with a review.
Rise of the Planet of the Apes does it right. It's a smart and thoroughly enjoyable summer diversion that entertains without insulting your intelligence. And it answers the question that's been hanging in the air since the first film came out in 1968. How did it happen that apes came to rule? It all starts with an earnest scientist named Will, played by James Franco, who's been working for years on a drug that would cure Alzheimer's. When his latest serum makes a startling improvement in a chimpanzee's cognitive skills, Will can barely contain his excitement.
We gave him a gene therapy that allows the brain to create its own cells in order to repair itself. We call it a cure to Alzheimer's.
But before the human testing can begin, the project is shelved. Will spirits a young chimp named Caesar out of the lab and raises him at home. He also gets his hands on enough of the serum to keep injecting the chimp. The results are remarkable at first, but we all know this is playing with fire. Neighbors complain, and Will is forced to leave Caesar in a primate sanctuary.
He hasn't spent any time with other chimps.
Oh, we're used to that. He'll be a little skittish at first, but we'll integrate him. You'll probably miss him more than he'll miss you. You'd be surprised how quick they adapt.
It's here that Caesar begins to gather his ape following. The key reason Rise has the impact it does is its use of state-of-the-art computer technology. It's a combination of motion capture and performance capture special effects that make the film's 150 or so digitally created apes look remarkably real. The results owe a lot to the actors who wear the motion capture suits, especially the great Andy Serkis, who played Gollum in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. That's him playing Caesar, the chimpanzee who becomes the he-who-must-be-obeyed godfather of all apedom. Caesar's facial expressions are essential to following this chimpanzee's complex mental states. This is one sophisticated animal, and one sophisticated summer blockbuster as well.
The movie is Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times. NASA's space shuttle program is finished, as we all know, but space exploration is not. Next month, two spacecraft will head for the moon.
In November, another spacecraft is bound for Mars. And later today, the spacecraft Juno is scheduled to launch from Cape Canaveral in Florida on a mission to Jupiter.
It will take 5 years to reach the solar system's largest planet. NPR's Joe Palca has more.
First, Jupiter. Why Jupiter? Well, it's big.
It's the largest of all the planets. In fact, it's got more material in it than all the rest of the solar system combined.
Scott Bolton is a planetary scientist at the Southwest Research Institute. Jupiter was also probably the first planet to form in our solar system.
And that's why it's very interesting to us if we want to go back in time and understand where we came from and how the planets were made. Jupiter holds this secret.
Bolton is principal investigator for the Juno mission.
What we're really after is discovering the recipe for making planets, and we're back at the first step of making sure we have all the ingredients in that recipe.
It'll take 5 years for Juno to reach Jupiter. Once there, it will have to avoid the intense bands of radiation that are near the giant planet.
Those radiation belts at Jupiter are the most hazardous region in the entire solar system, other than going right to the sun itself.
Just being near Jupiter's radiation belts meant adding a lot of shielding to protect Juno's sensitive electronics.
We're basically an armored tank going to Jupiter.
A 3,500-pound tank with three large solar panels and a bunch of scientific instruments. At Jupiter, Juno will go into an orbit that takes it over the poles.
Not only are we over the poles, but we're getting closer to Jupiter in our orbit than any other spacecraft has gone orbiting Jupiter. We're only 5,000 kilometers above the cloud tops.
That's about 3,000 miles. But if you think that's close, it's nothing like how close the Grail spacecraft will get to the moon.
We're actually going to be mapping the moon from 50 kilometers or about 30 miles above the surface.
Maria Zuber is a planetary scientist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and the principal investigator for Grail. The mission will map the moon's gravity. Orbiting that low means...
We're actually going to have a higher resolution gravity model for the moon than we have for the Earth right now.
Grail is actually two spacecraft, each about the size of a washing machine. They'll orbit the moon one behind the other. They'll measure tiny changes in their velocities caused by changes in the tug of gravity coming from the moon.
We can actually measure the velocity change between the two spacecraft to a few tenths of a micron per second, which is a micron is a millionth of a meter.
An accurate gravity map will provide clues to the core of the planet. Zuber says a planet is like a member of your family.
It's not what they look like on the outside that makes them special. It's what's going on the inside of them.
But scientists are still pretty interested in the outside of Mars. That's why NASA is sending another rover to land there. A year ago, I visited John Grotzinger at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. We talked standing on a balcony overlooking the clean room where the rover was being assembled.
Over here, then, you can see the rover, and just last week, the wheels were put on.
Grotzinger is principal investigator for the Mars Science Laboratory, the rover's formal name. It's about the size of a small, compact car. It's not going to bounce down to Mars the way the rover's Spirit and Opportunity did.
The Mars exploration rovers basically crash-landed softly with airbags. Mars Science Laboratory is so large that we need an active propulsion system.
In other words, a rocket-powered soft landing. It's a new system that involves a space crane that lowers the rover to the ground on a tether. Try to watch one of the simulation videos. There's a link on our website, npr.org. It's a wild landing scheme.
We're going to land a rover that can explore for habitable environments where microorganisms may have existed in the past or may possibly exist today.
The plan is for the rover to land in a place called Gale Crater. It will measure the minerals in the rocks to see if they make up an environment where life might have been possible, as well as compounds that might have been left behind by living organisms.
So we'll be able to look for large organic molecules if they exist in the rocks and soils.
Grotzinger admits that finding these organic molecules is a long shot, but he says Gale Crater seems to be the best place to look. Assuming all goes well, the Mars Science Laboratory will start its roving next summer. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington. Time now for our video pick of the week. Flora Lichtman, our multimedia editor, is here, and I know what you have in store because I've looked at this video and it's unbelievable.
I know, Ira. This is a video that I don't actually think we could oversell if we tried. This is a run, don't walk to your laptop or desktop computer video because it's really, your mind's going to be blown. It's going to be great.
Okay, now tell us what it is that we're going to be blowing.
Now that you're primed, it's about cephalopods, which are squid, octopus, and cuttlefish. And it's about how they camouflage and go in and out of hiding. And actually, we have the scientist who collected most of the footage in this video here with us. Roger Hanlon is a senior scientist at the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole. Hi, Roger. Welcome to Science Friday.
Yes, hello. Thanks. It's great to be here.
So the video you gave me, one of them, you call it your wow video. And so maybe you can tell us why you call it your wow video. Set the scene.
The scene is this. We're diving along a shallow coral reef in the Caribbean, and there's a rock sitting out in a sand plain all by itself, and it just looks like a plain, boring rock. And as the video comes a little bit closer to the rock, suddenly one-third of it turns into a bright white octopus that has been beautifully camouflaged and suddenly goes out of camouflage because the cameraman are so close, and then it inks in the face and zooms off. So it really was, I think I yelled wow at the moment.
Underwater.
Yes, I wasted a little air on that one.
And it happens really fast, right?
Yes, they can change their pattern and coloration in about one half of 1 second. So this is the fastest color change and the most diverse color change of any animal group we know of.
Well, this video is up on our website at sciencefriday.com. And when I saw it, I mean, it's not only is the color change, but the skin shape matches and the texture matches whatever it's near, right?
That's right. It's quite extraordinary. They not only change the pattern and the color and the contrast to achieve camouflage, but the three-dimensionality of the skin, the physical texture of the skin, changes to match the backgrounds as well. And that also is under visual control, and it's also very fast.
I mean, how do they do that? That's what I want to know. You look at the video, and you know, I've showed it to a bunch of people, and they're like, this has to be fake because it just looks so unbelievable. So what's involved?
Yes, at least half the people who look at this decide it's fake. So we do a lot of explaining in reverse, and by following this in reverse slow motion, you see some of the dynamics. The simple answer is that they do it visually. In other words, they have very keen eyes. The eyes are assessing the information immediately around them, and then with that visual information, they implement all these body patterns that means controlling over 30 million chromatophore organs. These are pigmented organs in the skin, all directly innervated from the brain. And to get those muscles to create the three-dimensionality, we call these papillae, also requires visual input and direct neural control. So it's all visual input and nervous system control of the skin. So we glibly call this electric skin sometimes.
So they don't have to touch anything. I mean, I think that's kind of an amazing thing, right? To make this three-dimensional skin, they don't have to actually feel it. They can just do it visually.
That's right. We've done controlled experiments on cuttlefish, which are related to octopus, and showed that just by visually looking at the fine texture of the background, they can reproduce that in the skin. There's some possibility that the octopus has used some of the touch receptors. We haven't done real experiments on octopus, but it seems as though most of it is driven by visual information only.
What about the colors? I think you told me that they're colorblind, so how are they matching the colors?
Right. This is one of the really vexing questions. How do you achieve colorblind camouflage if you're a soft-bodied, yummy animal in the ocean that everything's trying to eat? The simple answer is that we're not really sure. We have done experiments, and others have done experiments, to show that these animals don't have the equipment in the eye to perceive color, and behaviorally they don't react to color. However, they're doing a spectacular color match to every background they go on, and I should add that this octopus can move anywhere on a coral reef, which is the most visually diverse habitat on the planet, and they can achieve camouflage, including color matching. So I'm afraid we're a little ignorant in the science world to give you a good explanation of really how they do that color matching.
You know, people think about chameleons, I think, as sort of the quintessential camouflage animal. How do they rank up? If you were to put them in a competition for camouflage, who would win?
Well, the cephalopods win hand down. I think chameleons are
absolutely. When you see the
animals, but frankly, they're a little boring compared to the cephalopods, which can do it much faster and with much greater diversity.
Wow, that's amazing.
And did they evolve this over time? Do we see older, you know, are there any relatives of them that can't do it as well, but, you know?
Well, it turns out that all of the sort of extant or commonly seen cephalopods on the planet today can do all this beautiful color change. But remember, this is a mollusk. It's related to an oyster or a clam. And those animals certainly are different. They have shells on the outside. These animals, the cephalopods, have evolved very differently to get rid of all the external shell and to survive on their wits, so to speak, and that is they have good sensory systems, great coloration. And in one way, they manifest all of, let's say, all of their behaviors manifest through these patterns in the skin, whether it's signaling or communication or the opposite, which is camouflage.
Can they? Is it pretty predictable what pattern they're going to flash? If you put different animals in the same background, will you get the same pattern?
You do generally get the same pattern. Of course, there's variation, like in every species. But in general, the camouflage has to work every time, or, you know, they're no longer in the gene pool. The predation on these animals is very extreme. And so, yes, you put 10 octopuses on 10 of the same background, and you will generally get the same pattern response because the camouflage has to work in the context of that little microhabitat against which they're being viewed by these very capable predators.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow here with Flora Lichtman, talking with Roger Hanlon about the incredible video we have on our website at sciencefriday.com. Of an octopus or a lot of octopi. He says octopuses, not octopi.
Is it octopuses? I was wondering.
Changing to match their background, any shape, size, color, texture. And it's almost as if you look at the close-up of the skin that we have on the video, it's almost as if you're watching a high-definition video screen.
That's really quite a good analogy, Ira, because they do have these pigmented organs in the skin, and in a simplistic way, they turn some off and others aren't turned on to create the patterning. And they have three color classes, yellow, red, and brown, and that creates most of the patterning. But they also, underneath the pigments, they have reflectors or iridophores. They have an iridescent color, and they produce complementary colors so that the full artist palette of color is available through the skin here. And so this is very much like a high-resolution computer display.
Did they ever get? Did you ever try to trick them? I mean,
we
maybe a moiré pattern or something that's impossible or something that they can't do?
Yes, we do give them impossible backgrounds. This is called the psychophysics approach, where you try to cut down the number of variables so we can understand what they respond to. So we've given them black and white checkerboards, and believe me, I haven't seen any of those underwater yet. So these animals haven't evolved to something as ridiculous as that. But
give them a little bit of time.
Well, give them a little time. But it does tell us which part of the checkerboard they do pay attention to, and we do those controlled experiments so that we can understand what turns on the right camouflage pattern. And that's the nature of our laboratory experimentation here at the Marine Biological Lab.
Dr. Hinlan, what do they do when they're sleeping?
Well, we're not so sure they sleep. That's a controversial question, but I will tell you this. They stay camouflaged all day and all night. And we also know that the camouflage is beautifully tuned to the background, even under what we would call full darkness or starlight, and that they can even change under that level of light. So unlike humans, they can see in the dark, and that means they have some pretty good visual predators in the dark, too.
I would think that DARPA would be very interested in these guys. You know, the military.
There are a lot of people interested in these guys, partly for the bizarre factor. But if you think of advertising and material scientists and people who do anything with color and pattern, being able to change it like the skin of this animal is of great interest. And so we do a lot of work with the material science and engineering communities to try and produce changeable materials based on the skin of these animals.
And how many pixels. I mean, they're changing. They're controlling it. As I say, it looks like a high-definition TV screen. Are they actually controlling it? They all flash at the same time as if it is a screen. Is it like a pixelated sort of grid work, or how does it connect together?
Yes, it is a pigmented, pixelated sort of network, and the density is about 300 of those chromatophores per square millimeter, or you could call that dots per inch on a computer screen, and that is high resolution. And so, and there are a lot of species that have not so high resolution skin, depending on which complicated environment that species occurs in. But the one you're seeing on this video is one of the best camouflage artists of all the cephalopods. And yes, it is a high resolution screen, and it's a pretty diverse arrangement of skin patterns that it can produce.
And that is really, it's worth looking at this. I'd never seen anything like that. Dr. Hinlan, thanks for joining us on the show today.
No, it's my pleasure.
Roger Hinlan is a senior scientist at the Marine Biological Lab in Woods Hole.
And thank you, Flora. And if you want to see this video, and I'll tell you, if you want to see one video, this is the one to see this week. Up on our website at sciencefriday.com, it's our video pick of the week. It's an octopus that you will not be able to find in all kinds of places. Where's the octopus? Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
Great video. That's about all the time we have for today. Our program's senior producer is Annette Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Intagliata, Catherine Wells, Leshu Bayek. Sam Plato is our production assistant. Our intern is Ian Chant. Neil Roush is our technical director at the controls here in New York. And if you missed any part of our program, go download them on iTunes or subscribe to our podcast or audio and video. And you can even download this video of the octopus as a podcast. We have them up there on iTunes, and you can subscribe to our video podcast as well. And share this one with your folks this evening. I'm Ira Flato in New York.